Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. My colleague, Arianna Pelosi, spoke with Dr. Ryan Hassan-Charles about stepping into a new, first-of-its-kind role at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She will serve as the inaugural Vice Chair for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Department of Surgery, as well as an Associate Surgeon in the Division of Thoracic Surgery. She spoke about her career leading up to this point, and described new health equity initiatives she plans to pursue in her new role.
All right, so just to start off, can you just give a little background or insight into your career?
Sure. I was born and raised in Southern California, and I actually went to undergrad at UC Berkeley. I was a psych major, which definitely comes in handy in my current career. But I focused mostly on psych. And the funny thing is that I wanted to be a doctor my entire life. And since the age of 7, I think I wanted to be a chef briefly before that. And then I switched to wanting to be a doctor and never really thought about anything else. And so when I got to college, I was like, am I sure I want to do this? Are there other things I want to explore? And I took a bunch of different classes, but realized, nope, medicine is for me. And by that time, I was pretty far into my college education. And so I met with one of the counselors who said, hey, you should do a post-bac program. So I ended up doing that. That was my first time out here in Boston through Harvard Extension. I did a post-bac program. And then I went back to California to USC for medical school. Loved it. Worked at LA County. That was our main hospital there. Just had a great experience learning how to be a doctor, working with teams, you know, taking care of the sickest of the sick patients, you know, and patients that don't have easy access to care and helping them get the care that they need. And then I came back to Boston for the second time when I matched to Brigham and Women's for general surgery residency. And I would say those were definitely 7 of the most formative years of my life, 5 clinical and then 2 in the lab. I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Monica Bertinoli, who is now achieved fabulous things, but she was already fabulous when she was here, but I was able to do 2 basic science years with her and just grew so much in terms of my interest in cancer and research and understanding like how can we make a difference in what we're doing, not just on a day-to-day basis in the operating room, but in helping groups of people live better lives and live lives to the fullest like they should be able to with new therapies or treatments or screening, which is what I do now. So I loved my time here, realized I wanted to experience other organizations. So I actually went to The Ohio State for a cardiothoracic fellowship and then did a thoracic fellowship dedicated at Mayo Clinic, and loved both of those institutions, especially my training in thoracic at Mayo Clinic, because that's kind of where I was able to focus on my craft specifically. Had some fabulous mentors there. And then I got my first attending job at Dartmouth Hitchcock. I had 3 partners. They were amazing. My section chief, David Finley, was amazing and really helped me to not only pursue my interest in health equity, but also my interest in research, and kind of help meld the two, you know, that prepared me for this position that I have right now. I ended up getting my MPH when I was at Dartmouth, and I was doing it during COVID. It basically, I started in the fall of 2019. And so that first semester was when COVID happened. And when we had the summer of 2020, understanding, you know, all of these events that are happening that are bringing not only health equity to the forefront, but just equity in general, and the barriers that are within our society, such as racism, and that help to prevent not only people from living healthy lives, but patients actually getting adequate and much needed care. And so I developed a DEI curriculum for the public health school, which was amazing. Took it through the curriculum committee, got to teach it. And, you know, really sparked my interest towards that. And then at the same time, I was able to develop my lung cancer screening career, looking at our rural populations and really figuring out what the barriers and facilitators are to helping those patients get screened. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of lack of education and lack of access. And then when you live 120 miles away from the closest screening center, you know, figuring out how to get there and make that a priority. And so I was doing some other things, some mentorship. I was one of the advisors for the medical students in surgery. And so when this position, the call for this position came out, I said, you know, this is perfect because it's kind of blending everything that I've been working on in separate silos and giving it one central focus of improving health equity for all. And so that's pretty much how I got here.
You have a really great background, especially working with Dr. Bertignoli. And everything she's achieved in her career as well.
Yeah.
So looking at your current position, what are you most excited about to be Vice President of DEI at Brigham?
Yeah, so the most exciting thing is going to be putting health equity at the forefront of everything we do surgical. I think that before COVID and before all of this happened, we knew about health equity. We tried to do it. I think there was varying levels of success across the nation, not just, you know, within this part, but across the nation. And I think even just in the world in terms of not just medicine, but business and, you know, those fields, some had caught on that, like, listen, diversity works. It's important. We get better outcomes. We, you know, so many things are head more in the positive direction than the negative direction if we pay attention to this. But I really think that those events of the summer of 2020 and just COVID itself helped to open our eyes about the need to have this focus of health equity in everything that we do. And it's not just an afterthought or something that we sprinkle, you know, into what we're trying to do, but it's that, hey, when we're thinking about the operations of the department or the operations of the hospital, how are we making sure that we're doing this in an equitable fashion? How do we make sure that we are having a diverse workforce to answer these questions? So I think working on that being, I will commend the department here and how they've really made this position not just a standalone, hey, here's your office and start these initiatives, but no, we want you involved in the operations of how we run things. We want you in the important meetings. We want to, most importantly, hear your voice and hear what your thoughts are and help us, you know, guide us in terms of how we can do this equitably and meet the needs of the patients that we serve. So I think I'm most excited about that, and that hoping to hopefully make the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion something that we automatically think about instead of just an afterthought or something that we need to add to augment. No, this was thought about from the conception of whatever idea we're working on, and it's obvious in what we're doing and how we're taking care of patients.
So you may have just touched upon this in your previous answer, but are there any initiatives that you're looking forward to implementing?
Yeah, I think, you know, definitely you have to start from the ground up. So you have to start with the faculty that we already have in place here. I think making sure that not only our faculty, but our residents feel like they're included, and not just included, but that they belong within this department. Making sure that our patients feel like they belong at this hospital. You know, I've trained and have studied at many different health organizations, and you have many different patient populations. And, you know, Boston, it's unique in that we're an academic center, but we're also located in areas that don't have necessarily access to all of the things that we can provide. And we are very close to neighborhoods that have pretty significant disparities. And, you know, previously in the past may not have looked at our organization as, hey, I can go there and get great care. They are doing this for me to help me and my family. And so I think definitely from an inclusion and belonging standpoint, helping from all facets, faculty, residents, trainees, you know, and our patients feel like they belong, as well as the staff that help to take care of them. I think it's getting the data. How are we doing, you know, when it comes to these principles? How diverse is our workforce? What are our retention rates? Are we keeping people here? And if they're not staying here, are they going on to, you know, do bigger and better things? How much are we doing in the field of health equity? How much research are we doing? Are practices equitable in terms of who we're hiring, you know, and who we're getting to stay here? Are we mentoring in the correct way? And so I think those are some of the overarching principles that we're looking at. And then just helping to educate not only our department, but with the things that we start in our department to the world. So for example, you know, and Brigham had already been doing this within the Department of Surgery, but doing, you know, cultural sensitivity M&Ms, you know, and looking at cases that come up, whether they're within our hospital or others, you know, to see how can we do this better? How can we address this better? You know, creating a diversity curriculum for the staff and for the residents to, you know, learn about some of these principles. You're taught it, you hear it, but do we actually know what it is to speak about it in an intelligent fashion and then actually live it in the work that we're doing day to day? And then I think most importantly, the community connections that will be made through this position and helping specifically, you know, all patients, but especially I'm a cancer surgeon helping cancer patients. You know, the journey is long. It is often multidisciplinary and involves many different steps for you to go from diagnosis to hopefully treatment and cure, or treatment and stability, or, you know, even if it's to a palliative setting, doing that in a humanistic way and having empathy at the core of that. And, you know, providing those resources so that patients can travel that journey in a dignified fashion. So I'm excited of, you know, kind of piggybacking on the point of interweaving health equity in everything that we do, but focusing on those specific targets to really get the job done.
Great. So as this is an inaugural position, do you think there's any change or precedent that you'd like to set for this position moving forward?
Yeah, so I think for sure, you know, and I kind of touched on this a little bit before, but really just, you know, again, trying to make DEI something that's just a part of everything that we think of, just like we would think of, okay, how exactly are we going to do this? How are we going to afford this? How are we going to, you know, monitor this? Like data, financing, operations. Those are all, you know, terms, you know, DEI should be right there, like, and health equity, really, like, how are we doing all of this in an equitable fashion? What is the cost, and can the people that we serve afford this? You know, if they can't, what resources can we provide or help them with? You know, in terms of how we are rolling this out, is it just in certain neighborhoods, or are we doing this broadly? Are we actually going into the communities and partnering with communities to say, hey, we want to do this and we want to help and work with this community. How can we best do that? So I think that, I mean, Brigham Department of Surgery was already doing that to an extent, but I think, you know, kind of coming up with a unified way to do that, helping faculty that are already here and that will be coming in, and our residents, to think about that and do that in their daily interactions, as well as those that, you know, are, long-term programs or initiatives that they're trying to do. So I think I'm most excited about that, you know, and just making it that, like, this is something we think about just like everything else. I hope it would ideally get to the point where this position is not even required anymore, because we just do it so well that, hey, this is what we do, you know, and like maybe we have a person that thinks like even bigger and better, but we all do this anyways on an everyday basis. And the metrics show that we do this in terms of the patients we're serving, our outcomes, you know, and the happiness of our faculty, staff, and residents.
I really like that thought. Hopefully we'll eventually get there one day, but
for one now, day, one day.
You're helping the process along. Yeah. For this next question, I kind of put two together. Just looking as a thoracic surgeon, have you been involved in any groundbreaking research? And if you haven't particularly, over the course of your career, has there been any research that you thought was impactful? You can kind of break this up if you want to just do one at a time, though.
Yeah, so I think two things. First one, yes, I have been involved in some groundbreaking and then done hopefully what people may consider groundbreaking research of their own. When I was with Dr. Bertinoli in her lab, you know, she was the one that did the APC trial and pretty much, you know, put that on the map. And, you know, we looked at Vioxx and all of the COX-2 inhibitors and everything and how they work. I think that was my first introduction to understanding, hey, you know, we have an opportunity to actually change the way that we practice medicine. We cannot do the way things the same, you know, from like the training from that I got as an intern is much different than the training the interns get now. It's so funny. I used to mentor the medical students, you know, formally at Dartmouth Hitchcock. And, you know, I would tell them, like, listen, I applied to residency and medical school a very, very long time ago, and you guys do things differently, but that's a great thing because we have learned so much about how to do things correctly and more equitably. So you have a greater chance at this. But I think going back to that, I think being in her lab was my first opportunity to be involved, because we did some projects that carried on that research and looked at it more specifically in the patients that we serve here at Brigham and Women's. Throughout my career, and once I got to Dartmouth-Hitchcock, I was able to get introduced to Dr. Bill Black, who was a radiologist, but he was one of the key site PIs for the lung cancer screening trial that basically put on the map that said, hey, if you are between the ages, and it used to be older criteria, 55 and 80, if you have a 30-pack to your history, or if you continue to smoke, or if you have quit within the last 15 years, you need to get screened. And so they actually compared getting a low-dose CT to getting a chest x-ray, and saw that, whoa, there's a 20% mortality difference in patients that participate in this, but also there's almost an 8% overall mortality. So we're not even talking about lung cancer, but anything, you know, different if you are able to participate in this. And so through that, I have been able to look at, you know, and living in Dartmouth-Hitchcock, which is halfway up New Hampshire, it's only about 3 hours, give or take, from the Canadian border. So we're pretty high up there. We have populations of patients that come from both New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, some come from New York, etc. And some of them do not have access to an accredited lung cancer screening facility. So one of the things that I was interested in is, how can we increase access? You know, well, we can do that by bringing this, you know, lung cancer screening to these populations, you know, through mobile units. They've done it in mammography, they've done it in, you know, cervical cancer and all of different types. Why can't we do it in lung cancer? You know, prop a van in the, Walgreens parking lot, you know, every 4 months, advertise to the community, do it on a day when we could potentially do other screenings and help get people enrolled. And so there was many iterations of this idea, you know, and many grants that were submitted that were rejected, but I was lucky enough to get funding from the National Institute of Health through a COBRI grant for Dartmouth-Hitchcock to do this work and help pilot this. We got through the first day, we're getting through the first day. We did not get to finish the rest because I took this position, but I'm actually excited that they were excited here to continue that work in some of the urban populations and underserved populations that we have here, especially the Black and Caribbean populations that we have here, which is near and dear to my heart. I became a thoracic surgeon because I said, Black people get lung cancer too, but there's so few of us that are actually there that they can see and get care from. And we know that coordinate care helps improve outcomes. And so I'm excited to continue that research and, you know, help not only contribute to my division's, you know, goals, but those of the hospital and of the community that we serve, and show them that, hey, screening works. Let's get you screened. And if we find something, we're here to take care of it.
That's great. I'm glad you got to see that beginning, and hopefully you'll get to finish that in Boston as well.
Yeah.
So looking at thoracic surgery as a whole, where do you see the field headed over maybe the course of the next 5 years?
Yeah. So, you know, the great thing is that we will never die out as a field, I think, because we're always reinventing the wheel. You know, it started way back at the beginning of time where, you know, the main surgery that we did was pneumonectomies. And then we realized, no, okay, actually, we don't have to take the whole lung. We can take just a lobe. Then we realized, hey, sampling lymph nodes really helps us when we're doing cancer surgery. And so, you know, it's gone through this metamorphosis. Previously, every surgery was done through a thoracotomy. Then we went to VATS. Now we have robotics. And we also have uniportal surgery. I think that we've expanded where we used to do a mediastinoscopy on everybody. We now have EBUS, you know, that we can use. I think so we're always forward thinking, you know, using a lot of imaging and combining. One of the clinical trials that we're doing here is that patients get a nodule either removed the standard way, or they get it removed with imaging so that we can see exactly this is what we took. So I think it's going more and more towards minimally invasive techniques, patient-specialized care. So the whole field of immunotherapy has transformed us dramatically. You know, our esophageal cancer patients, after going through that huge surgery, we now have an option for them instead of saying, like, hey, there's still four lymph nodes that were positive. Okay, let's get you some immunotherapy, you know, and help to try to eradicate this. I think with our lung cancer patients, the same thing, you know, and even starting to trial that, you know, pre-op versus post-op. I think that, the other thing is just, you know, along those lines of the immunotherapy is just that specialized care and trying to see what can we bundle in one visit so that you're not coming to the hospital, you know, three or four times, but we're getting you here once, maybe twice. You know, how can we speed up the diagnosis process? So I think we're always innovating. My hope is that in terms of screening, specifically for lung cancer, you know, and they're already doing this and you know, for example, at Mayo Clinic, they have Canary, but using, you know, artificial intelligence to help guess, hey, is this lung nodule positive? Is it negative? We've done that in the cancer framework, but in terms of screening nodules, you know, coming up with some sort of paradigm of like, okay, can the technology look at this and say, hey, there's about, you know, 85% chance that this is cancer. We need to do this, this, and this. I think it will help patient peace of mind. I think that it will help cut down costs and help to eliminate some of the unnecessary testing or extra testing that we have to do just to be sure. But I'm excited because there's so much innovation going on in so many different areas. And we are also attacking, you know, a lot of different cancers, specifically lung cancer, at multiple steps. So lung cancer, it used to be a death sentence. People here are like, ooh, lung cancer. You know, but now we're number one diagnosing it so much earlier. But then also, in case that you're not diagnosed early, we have so many different adjuncts that we could use to help get you a better outcome. And so, even with stage four disease, you know, we are seeing patients that are not just living 3 to 6 months, but they're living years. And so, I'm excited. We're always innovating and it's not just in one field, it's in many, and it's at many different stages of the disease process. So we're not going anywhere. So I think that's helpful.
I like the concept of AI for screening. I think they use a lot in treatment and testing, but not for screening and preventative health. So
Exactly. And I think so many patients worry about the, you know, the finance. We hear all of this about financial toxicity and how much this actually costs to the patient to undergo cancer care. And that's one of the many things to add to the list of why patients present late or don't present at all, you know, and then, or once they're here, they're not able to participate in some of the treatments that would best serve them because of the fear of cost. And so if we can cut that down, or if we can also just help to reassure patients that, like, listen, the chance of this being cancer is less than 5%, you know, so let's keep watching it. We're not going to ignore it, but we have the technology to help tell us that.
so these last two questions I added on, we have a Women in Oncology series at Cancer Network, so I just tacked these on. So looking at the course of your career, did you ever face any difficulty breaking into the thoracic surgery field?
I think, you know, the first, yes, I will say the first one was just, you know, having role models that look like you in the field. You know, when I was coming into thoracic or cardiothoracic surgery, there were only five Black board certified surgeons in the nation. You know, we're now up to about 17 or 18, but it's still, you know, the fact that you can count that on, you know, four hands is kind of crazy, especially when you think that there's 7,000, over 7,000, close to 8,000 board certified, you know, cardiothoracic surgeons in the world. And so I think not being able to see that was tough, but I am so happy that I had mentors that nevertheless, you know, showed me what it was like to be a great surgeon and made me want to do this. And, you know, just through their actions. And, you know, I didn't necessarily have to see what I wanted to be in order to be it. And that kind of goes to, you know, advice for future surgeons is don't be afraid to have mentors that don't look like you, you know, whether it's, you know, all different things, whether it's race and ethnicity, whether it's, you know, gender, etc., because there's so much to learn from everyone. So I think that was the first barrier. I think, it can definitely be very lonely at times. My senior year as a chief cardiothoracic fellow, I was the only woman in the program. It's my picture with my graduating picture. It's, like my co-fellow, and then all of my attendings, and just me. I was lucky that my first year there was another woman in the program, but I think, being the only one is hard. And I think people don't understand the things that you miss out on, conversations that you're having, and then you get to the men's locker room and the conversation continues and you break off, just things like that. And so I think, I did not have children while I was in residency, but I can only imagine, what that was. And having my first child as an attending, I was lucky that I had very, very supportive partners, that were encouraging of that, and then also understanding of that too as well. So, and then just being a Black woman, and being Black, a woman, and left-handed in cardiothoracic surgery. I mean, there's not too many other, things that you could do that could help to try to impede your progress. But again, I was so extremely fortunate to be surrounded by mentors, that looked out for me, and two, to have the determination, that, hey, I can do this, because of their consistent feedback. And then three, I think, being able to find people that saw more in me than I saw in myself, because I think that, you need that in order to accomplish many things in life, and not all of us are fortunate to find that. So when you do, holding on to that, and understanding that sometimes they'll have more faith than you do that things will work out, but continuing to have that faith and helping that get you through.
Yeah, it sounds like you had really good mentors, and now you've accomplished so much in your career and a good mentor to junior faculty coming in as well. So,
Definitely.
would you have any advice that you would want to give to junior faculty members just starting out in their careers?
Yes, dream big is number one. I think that, the field of surgery has changed so much, and so much for the better. I think there's so many different opportunities for you to pursue. Definitely at the core of everything, we're surgeons. But, for example, this position, and positions in administration in general weren't like a reality when I was going through training. It was like you surgery. You can potentially be a surgeon scientist, or you can be chair of the department. And those are like kind of the main fields. Now you can branch into education. You can have that research stronghold. You can branch into teaching, and curriculum development. You can branch into administration and helping things at a hospital-wide level as opposed to just, a departmental or division or section level. I think we will always need excellent teachers for the residents and the medical students that are coming up behind us. So I think I say all of this to say that the options are aplenty. And so don't feel confined by, the box that surgery often has in the public, of what our lifestyle is like or what the career options are. I think definitely seeking mentorship and mentors in all areas, realizing that if you only have one mentor, you probably need more. And that, when I say, for example, when I started my first faculty job, I had a mentor for my research. I had a mentor for my clinical practice. I had a mentor that, was a surgeon but wasn't involved in my section, just could give me insight on everything, whether it's like when's the best time to have kids to when is the best time, finding a partner and all of those different things. I think that, it's important to have that in your life, and don't be discouraged if you're hoping to have mentorship with one person and it doesn't work out. The world of building has millions and billions of people, so you will find that person. Just, stay focused. I think the third thing is don't lose yourself in the process. Pay attention to the family, friends, partners, everybody that has been with you from the beginning, because they'll be the ones that are with you as you go through this journey. They'll be the ones that you want to celebrate with when real big things actually happen. No surgeon ever looks at the end of their career and is like, oh my gosh, I wish I would have operated more. I wish I would have come to clinic more. I wish I would have done more cases. No, it's, I wish I would have spent more time with my family. I wish I would have been there for those events. So don't lose focus on that. And then I think just realize, the world is your oyster. This position is a dream position for me because it's bringing together everything that I love to do, you know, and having focus to it. And I encourage people coming up, find your focus, find your passion, find the thing that makes you, you know, keeps you up at night because you're thinking about like, oh, I need to take notes, you know, or that wakes you up in the morning is like, oh, I'm excited to go in and work on this, you know, because you can do whatever you set your mind to. And with today's resources, there should be nothing that limits you. And there may be things that seem like they're discouraging, but you have the power to overcome those and, you know, collaborate with people that will help generate success. So do that.
All right, great. Those are all of my questions. Did you have anything else that you wanted to touch upon today?
I don't think so. I think, you know, the biggest thing, one of the things I was going to say is, you know, I'm excited with this position, you know, as a cancer surgeon to particularly pay attention to our cancer patients, because I feel like, you know, there's many different fields of surgery. There's surgeries where, you know, you come in, you see the surgeon, you have your operation and you're fine. There's trauma surgery where you come in, you get treated, you know, it may or may not involve surgery, but hopefully you recover and then you go on. And then there's cancer where there's the whole diagnosis phase, there's the whole treatment phase, which may be multimodal, then there's the whole survivorship phase, like what, you know, you did make it through, so now what? I'm excited to, you know, really instill the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and really just health equity in that process, and making that easier for patients to navigate, helping them to go through that process feeling like they belong and that they have a place here and that people are supremely invested in their, you know, outcomes and how they do and them as people, not just as patients. And it's not that we don't already do that, but just helping to augment the efforts, you know, that we're already doing to just give our patients, especially our cancer patients and our also underserved patients. There's a significant racial ethnic minority patient, and we have a lot of people from the African diaspora that are here and helping them to get the care that they receive, that they need to receive too as well. So super excited about a lot.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.